Go ahead and turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. And as you make your way there, let me just let you know how thankful I am for the basketball coaches I have had along life's way who have shaped me into the beautifully perfected basketball machine that is standing before you this morning. This may surprise you, but I haven't always been as skilled as I am now at basketball or as humble about basketball at this very moment. When I went out for basketball in the seventh grade, it wasn't because I had any desire to play basketball at all. I hadn't watched basketball. I really hadn't played it. When there were options at recess time, there may have been a few times I'd go and shoot around, but for the most part, I was running around playing football or hanging on the jungle gym, all that kind of stuff. I didn't really have an interest in basketball. So the reason I did go out for it had to do with the fact that in the sixth grade, some classmates of mine in that small class, which if you remember last week, I had a picture of our small class, a bunch of the guys went out for basketball and I did not. And so I would come to school the next day and those classmates would share. Some people are already loving the picture up on the screen. So the classmates would talk about, they went to this game and this is what happened, and then I was the odd man left out. And so I didn't like that feeling. And so when it came to my seventh grade year, I thought, I don't want to be the odd person out. I'm going to go out for basketball, even though I don't know much about it. So when it came to that very first practice, I had to learn the basics of basketball. I had to learn how to dribble. I remember how awkward it was learning to dribble, and I was already going through that growth spurt type thing, and so you're shooting up and you're getting used to a new body that's growing. So I was having to learn how to pass, I was learning how to dribble, I was learning how an offense works. You have a team, you're trying to work together, and you're learning plays on offense and defense. So I was learning all sorts of things, but unfortunately in the middle of all of those things I was learning, one of the things that very first coach I had did not teach me was the fundamentals of shooting. And because I've never really shot the ball before then, I had practiced a little bit on my own, getting ready in those weeks before, I had a little bit of a two-handed shot. I actually brought my basketball this morning. I had a little bit of a two-handed shot. So both hands were a part of it. I'd throw it up there, and I had both hands in there. And if you know anything about basketball, a two-handed shot is not at all what you want to have. But that first basketball coach never said anything about it, never tried to correct anything about it, and so that's what I had. And after my seventh grade year basketball season, we moved to another house. We had this big, huge 10-foot by 15-foot concrete slab out in the yard, and my dad put up a basketball hoop, and I practiced a ton. I was out there almost every single day. I remember scraping snow and ice off of that slab so I could keep practicing, and I would wear a basketball out. I would get one, it'd have the little grips on it, the little bubbles, and I would wear it out till it was about as smooth as you could get, and then I needed to get another one. So when I did all that practicing, I practiced that two-handed shot a lot. And if you practice anything for a period of time, you're going to get good at it, even if it's a bad habit. And when it came down to it, there are coaches that do not care what your shooting form looks like. The only thing they care about is whether the shot goes in through the hoop. And so for 5 years, from seventh grade all the way till my junior year of high school, I had five different coaches who looked the other way on my shot because the shots were going in enough, and so they didn't want to mess with anything. It wasn't worth fixing in their eyes. But then there was this other coach. He wasn't my basketball coach. I did not have him for any of those basketball years. He was the high school track coach for the guys. He was also, like a lot of coaches, they coached a couple different things. He was my track coach for 4 years, but he was the girls' basketball coach for decades. And every year, the basketball season would finish for the guys, and I had a couple weeks off, and then track would get started. And every single year, after my freshman year, sophomore year, and junior year, that coach, Don Wallace, would hassle me and say, "You need to fix your shot." And I would tell him, "Hey, I averaged like 15 points a game this year. Why do I need to change my shot? I'm doing fine." He's like, "I know you're doing fine, but you need to change your shot, and you will do so much better if you do." Well, after my junior year, like I said, he had hassled me every year of high school. After my junior year, we had a horrible, and I mean absolutely horrible basketball season. 1-21. One win, 21 losses. It was not fun. And at the end of that year, I thought, I'm not going out for basketball again. Like, this is it. And so he was hassling me again, and I told him, I don't know if I'm going to go out for basketball anyways, so sure, what have I got to lose? Help me with my shot, and then if I don't go out, what have I lost? And so every day after track practice, for about 3 weeks, I would finish track practice, and he would do shooting drills with me. And really, for the first week, I knew I was going to drop it. For the first week, the only thing I did for that first week was these little flip shots. Not even really shooting the ball, just to get the wrist going in a certain rhythm, because the problem I had was I had two hands trying to do things, and he needed to get rid of the one hand. And so for 1 week, that's all I did was one-handed shots. And even now, when I go to the gym and I'm warming up, a lot of times I'll sit there and just flip it around for a little bit just to get my wrist doing what I need it to do. And I'll usually use a line. So like this has a little line going across, and I'll flip it and make sure I keep it straight. And that's what I did to fix my shot. Skip way ahead here. So the reason he had that, and then he would move on to other things, practice jumping and shooting. But anyways, 3 weeks to work on that shot. And then the rest was history after that. A little over a year ago, I was leaving the rec center, and as I was leaving, there was this taller gentleman, maybe 6'6", 6'7", somewhere around there, an older gentleman. And as I was walking out, he stopped me. And never met the guy before. He had been shooting around on the other side of the court, but he was watching me play and watching me shoot. And I had a pretty decent night that night. And when I was walking out, he stopped me. He said, "Hey, you've got a really nice shooting form." And I was, thank you very much. I was very honored. Well, come to find out, he played college ball, Division I college ball here in the States, and then he played international ball in Australia. So he played for it was basically like an NBA version of a team in Australia, the Sydney Kings. So I'm thinking, oh, wow, I've got an international basketball player complimenting me on my shooting form. So I was immediately honored, but I had to tell him about Coach Wallace. I said, you know what, I didn't always have a good shooting form, but I did have a coach who stepped in and said, hey, I can show you a better way to shoot. Now go ahead and stand with me as we read from Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, I'm going to read verses 1 through 12. Now when he, Jesus, saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Go ahead and have a seat. The word of the Lord this morning. Last week's message finished with an invitation offered by Jesus to a group of fishermen who were busy fishing for fish. And the invitation was, "Come, and I will make you fishers of men." What follows that invitation is essentially an orientation time. So maybe if you've ever started a new job, you have an orientation phase that you go through. Maybe you have orientation training or classes you have to go through to get acclimated to the place where you're at. What Jesus has with these early disciples is an orientation teaching moment. A teaching moment that we, if you've been a part of the church for a long time, know of as the Sermon on the Mount. It's the point where Jesus begins to take these fishermen of fish and begins to shape them into fishermen of people. Jesus begins a process of taking these fishermen as well as other occupations. They weren't just fishermen. There was a tax collector, and there was some other occupations in the mix. But he takes them, and he's going to shape them into fishers of men. It's worth noting that the disciples that Jesus initially collected were not non-religious people. They weren't irreligious. They weren't oblivious to religious practices. They were primarily Jewish people who were following him. So initially, these were not worldly, godless people that Jesus is going to somehow shape into godly people. These were followers of what seemed to be God-fearing Jewish men who were by no means elite religious leaders or scholars or anything like that, but neither were they religiously illiterate. There were plenty of things that they would have learned as a part of their Jewish upbringing in a family of Jewish people and as a part of their routine in going to the synagogues and listening to religious leaders. These were religious people who have been living their lives in a certain way for most of their lives, if not all of their lives, and doing it as best as they can, to the best of their abilities, to the best of their understanding. They have been learning as they go, and they have had people with religious authority coach them on the lives they're supposed to be living. And then along comes Jesus. Jesus wants to show them a much better way to live their lives. And one of the recurring lines that Jesus has, if you go through the Sermon on the Mount, which we'll go through all of it later, one of the recurring lines is, "You have heard that it was said, but I tell you." Jesus offers up alternative guidelines for people's lifestyle. And the lifestyle alternatives that he offers are not absolutely opposed to what was taught, but it is a finer way to do it. Kind of like when you're tweaking the shot. My shot wasn't absolutely horrible, but it needed some work. And so when Jesus goes through the law of Moses, he's letting them know things have went off track, things have gotten distorted in some ways, and he's going to get their shot fixed, so to speak. The law of Moses came to the people of God as a gift from God on Mount Sinai. And then a few hundred years later, you get Jesus sitting on a mountainside ready to deconstruct that way of life, a life that's been distorted along the way. Unfortunately for these early disciples, Jesus was intimately aware of the original intent of the law of Moses and each and every one of those laws because Jesus was intimately connected to the author of the law. Who better to teach these disciples about the law and how to implement it into their lives than Jesus? No one better than Jesus and no place better than a mountainside to add to the significance of what Jesus is going to do by addressing these specific laws in the Sermon on the Mount. But before Jesus gets to all of those kinds of laws, before Jesus gets to those laws and tries to steer them back on course, we have this little thing at the beginning called the Beatitudes. It's a very poetic orientation time for the disciples just getting started and wanting to know what this life is going to look like. On first glance, it doesn't seem to be the kind of exciting thing you would want to hear in an orientation. If you go to have a new job and they're doing an orientation, a lot of times they want to be really excited and upbeat because they really want you to love this new job you're going to do. And so a lot of times they show you the good things to look forward to. But when you look at the Beatitudes and you start to read through them, maybe on the first glance, it doesn't seem like something exciting you might want to sign up for. A business that wants to attract and retain good employees will put time and attention toward its orientation process so new employees are encouraged and affirmed and acclimated to the way that business does things. The very last thing a business would want is for new employees to be overwhelmed and discouraged on the front end. And let's just say that Jesus' opening orientation remarks in the Sermon on the Mount are not what any business would recommend. However, the things that Jesus offers up in the beginning of this Sermon on the Mount are as foundational and as fundamental as you can get for the life of a follower of Jesus. So here we go. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who know what it means to be spiritually impoverished. People naturally know what physical poverty feels like. If you're hungry, you have that hunger in your stomach. If you have financial poverty, you know what it's like for the money to run out too soon. If you don't have a warm place on a cold day, you know what it's like to be cold and shiver and have goosebumps. That kind of a poverty is blatant and undeniable and easy to point out. However, this world is filled with people who have more than enough food. They have a warm place to call home. They have enough money in the bank account. They've not experienced any level of physical poverty, but they are completely unaware of spiritual poverty. They may feel a void or an emptiness, but they do not recognize it for what it is. A spiritual void will never, ever be filled by anything physical in this world. Blessed are those who know that there are forms of poverty that need to be addressed. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Their spiritual need will get filled when the kingdom of heaven comes to where they are. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who recognize there's a tremendous gap between the way this world is and all of its pain and all of its brokenness and the way God desires this world to be. The tremendous gap in our world in general, a world perfectly created, now marred by the destructive power of sin. There's also the tremendous gap that can exist in our own lives in particular, the gap between the way we are living and the way we are called to live. Blessed are those who mourn over those gaps, for they will be comforted. People who are going to be comforted because God is going to close those gaps so that one day all will be as God desires it to be. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who know how to submit and yield. In a world that celebrates and admires strength and power, it is really easy to see submission as weakness. The meek are weak. The meek are vulnerable. The meek can be easily overpowered. And yet Jesus says, the meek shall inherit the earth. The meek shall inherit the earth because they know how to submit and yield to the will of the God who created the earth. The earth is not theirs to conquer. The earth is not theirs to claim as their own. The earth is a gift of God to those meek folks who fully submit to the desires of God. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. There are some scholars who believe that this fourth beatitude is kind of a summation of the three that come before it. What might result from people recognizing their spiritual poverty, grieving the gap in their own life and in the world, and how it should be, and those people also submitting to God? I think it's safe that what might result from people who go through those steps of recognizing their void, recognizing the gap in the world and submitting to God, from all those things, what would most likely happen would be a tremendous hunger and thirst for the righteous things of God. Because only God can fill that void. Only God has the power to fix that brokenness. And only God has the power, the ultimate power, unlike the power brokers, the people that think they can claim things through their own power. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful. Now, a lot of the latter Beatitudes, one of the things, the first four really do focus on our posture toward God. This one is a transition where this one is about our posture toward our brothers and sisters in this world. Being fully aware of the shortcomings of our own shortcomings in the sight of God, it's entirely unreasonable to refuse to offer forgiveness and mercy to those who fall short in their dealings with us. In the eyes of the world, mercy looks careless, because being merciful opens you up to the possibility of getting hurt by the people you've shown mercy to, people who may have a history of hurting others. And that's one of those things I actually experienced recently, just a coworker situation. I got the advice from numerous people, be careful, don't befriend that person, be careful. And in the other ear, I heard a singular voice saying, be a friend to that person, be merciful. Blessed are those who extend mercy to others, for you will receive mercy in return. Blessed are the pure in heart. Only a pure heart can fully love God and fully love one's neighbor as himself. I don't know if you've ever had to drive with a filthy windshield when the windshield washer fluid goes bad. It seems like the windshield washer always runs out in the middle of winter. You know, you're driving down the road, all that slush is getting washed up on your windshield and you're trying to get it clean so you can see. Very dangerous situation, but that's usually how it goes, at least with my cars when I'm driving. So when the windshield is filthy, it's hard to see clearly what's going on and you're a danger to yourself and others. Navigating our way through this life in ways that are loving can only happen with a purified heart where the windshield has been wiped clean. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God and they will see what God is up to in this world. a world that God dearly loves and wants us to love as well. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who can do more than just stop a fight. Blessed are those who can bring about actual reconciliation between enemies who were fighting. Restoring a relationship, when you've got people who are enemies and there's a conflict that needs to be resolved, restoring a broken relationship is a much greater feat than simply getting them to stop the violence. Far too often, the pause in violence is just temporary because relationships were never restored. People are content when the fighting stops and that's it. But that's really just the beginning. Without that reconciliation, sooner or later, the conflict will resume. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God, because they are doing exactly what God the Father has been doing in Christ, chiefly reconciling the world back to himself. For while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, with a huge emphasis on the righteousness part. Persecution can just as easily happen through a pursuit of self-martyrdom, and there's no reward for self-made martyrs. What an odd conclusion to the orientation Beatitudes for Jesus' followers. So you want to be a follower, you want to be a fisher of men. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Who in their right mind would sign up for that kind of a life? That sounds like absolute foolishness. And yet, what did Larry read earlier in the service? The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. This entire list of Beatitudes, capped off by persecution and rejoicing, is utter foolishness to this world. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. This morning, we have the opportunity to celebrate the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus through the sacrament of communion. When Jesus initially laid out those Beatitudes for those initial disciples just getting started, I'm sure they thought it all sounded pretty foolish. But do you know who the very first person was to sign up for that life that Jesus talked about? It wasn't a disciple. It was Jesus himself. Jesus signed up first. He was the one that they were going to be following, and so Jesus experienced all of that first. He experienced the brunt of an insult and persecution before they did. And Jesus has already experienced the reward of that life. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven. While we do remember Jesus' sacrificial death through communion, following some of the most extreme persecution you can possibly imagine, we also remember in communion that Jesus is resurrected and is now seated at the right hand of his Father in heaven. This morning, the invitation is to continue to follow in the steps of Jesus, to be willing to go where Jesus goes, to be willing to endure what he endures. And if your desire this morning is to follow Jesus, I'm going to actually sing a song first, but then the invitation of the song is, "Come to the Table." And I'm going to try to sing it after wearing out my voice for a few minutes, but wonderful song. It's a perfect song for communion. So after we finish this song, we'll have an invitation to come and gather around the table.